Good evening. Dr. Fauci throws the first pitch, and it's a curveball. Pompeo opens a Cold War against China. Would Richard Nixon approve? And small business in New York under threat. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, July 24th, 2020. The Trump administration unveiled four executive orders today aimed at bringing down pharmaceutical prices, a last-ditch effort by the White House to cut drug costs before the November election. It's not clear how quickly the reforms can be finalized. The most dramatic aspect of the announcement include a one-month ultimatum for drug manufacturers to propose alternative plans to reduce drug prices. Trump said if he remains unsatisfied, he would revive a long-stalled plan to cap U.S. drug prices based on what drug makers charge in foreign countries. And Dr. Anthony Fauci has been trying to get Americans to flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic. Last night, his curve was a little flat as he flung a wild pitch to start the long-delayed baseball season. The Yankees defeated the Washington Nationals 4-1.
What you'll see from baseball 2020, we get a real good feel for tonight. And now one of the more well-known Washington National fans, Dr. Anthony Fauci, to throw out the first pitch.
Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Before the game in front of an empty stadium and prior to the national anthem, most of the players of both teams kneeled for about 20 seconds. Last season, just one player taking a knee would have been seen as a radical statement. On Thursday at the Yankees batting practice, most players and manager Aaron Boone had worn Black Lives Matter t-shirts. Fauci, a member of the White House's coronavirus task force, has consistently scored higher in opinion polls than Trump in his handling of the pandemic. Fauci, 79, grew up in post-war Brooklyn, idolizing Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle. He was captain of the St. Regis basketball team, and he often uses sports analogies to communicate to the public. He remains a Nationals fan. It was back to business for Fauci on Friday, though. In an interview with the Washington Post, Fauci says he supports new CDC guidelines on the reopening of schools.
I think the CDC has put some good guidance down. I just took a quick look at them before I started into the program, which was sent to me by my colleagues at the CDC. So I think it's a sound set of guidelines.
What are the facts, Dr. Fauci, about children under 10 as spreaders? Secretary DeVos, Secretary of Education, recently said, quote, more studies show that kids are actually stoppers of the disease. Is that true?
You know, I'm not going to either agree with or disagree
right,
with
but what
someone.
Are the facts? What are the facts, yeah, though, on this?
I will give you the facts, okay? The reason is otherwise it gets taken out of context. There was a study that was done, and I think we still need to learn a lot about children, you know, elementary school children, getting infected, what the percentage of their infection is, and whether they either spread or not efficiently to adults. A recent study came out that showed children up to 10 years old, it looks like they don't necessarily spread infection as readily as adults do, whereas children 10 to 19 appear to be spreading infection to adults as equally as well as adults spread to adults. Yet there's still a lot to learn about what the prevalence and incidence of infection is in children. And as a group, do they spread? Do they get antibodies? What's the in-family spread or not? And in that regard, in order to answer that question, Bob, we started a study on May 1st. We'll get some answers by December of this year, a study called HERO Study, Human Epidemiology and COVID Virus Infection, looking at 6,000 people and 2,000 families to ask just those questions. How frequently do they get infected? And if they do, do they transmit it to adults? And would they be part of the spread of infection? Because even though we have some information about that, we still need more information.
But Dr. Fauci, if we still need more information, how can parents feel comfortable sending their children back to school?
Well, you know, sending children back to school, the parents are fundamentally concerned about whether they are going to get infected in school. And they certainly can get infected. It may be not very efficient, or it may be very efficient. So the parents' concern, I think, has a little bit different to do from the question you just asked me about when you send them to school, depending upon the level of infection in the community and what the recommendations are. So your questions are related, but they're a little bit different, I think.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The British press is reporting Secretary of State Mike Pompeo launched an extraordinary attack on the World Health Organization during a private meeting in the UK. Pompeo accused WHO of being in the pocket of China and responsible for dead Britons during the pandemic. Pompeo also accused WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom of being too close to Beijing. Pompeo told his audience of 20 members of parliament he was on a firm intelligence foundation, adding, a deal was made with China to allow Tedros to win election in 2017. Director Adhanom rejected Pompeo's comments. He says it's time to stop playing COVID politics.
The comments are untrue and unacceptable, and without any foundation for that matter. And our sole focus and the focus of the international, the entire organization is on saving lives. If there is one thing that really matters to us and which should matter to the entire international community, it's saving lives. And WHO will not be distracted by these comments, and we don't want the international community also to be distracted. As you know, one of the greatest threats we face continues to be the politicization of the pandemic. COVID-19 does not respect borders, ideologies, or political parties. And I have said it many times, COVID politics should be quarantined.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom. In May, President Trump announced that the U.S. was terminating its relationship with the global health body and said Beijing had total control over it. He also claimed that China pressured the WHO to mislead the world when the virus was first found in Wuhan. Pompeo visited the U.K. after Boris Johnson's government announced it was removing Chinese telecoms firm Huawei from U.K. 5G networks, concerned over potential risks to national security. In what some are calling an unusual whole-of-government approach, Pompeo explained the Trump administration's decision to close the Chinese consulate in Houston earlier this week, an action almost unheard of against large powers.
This is not just American intellectual property, but stolen. It's been European intellectual property, too, costing hundreds of thousands of jobs, good jobs for hardworking people all across Europe and America, stolen by the Chinese Communist Party. You saw yesterday an indictment that the Department of Justice put out related to a set of activities that were taking place not only in the United States but across other countries as well. And your point that this has been going on for a long time makes our point. President Trump has said enough. We're not going to allow this to continue to happen. You've seen the remarks that National Security Advisor O'Brien gave, that FBI Director Wray gave, and that Attorney General Barr has given. We are setting out clear expectations for how the Chinese Communist Party is going to behave. And when they don't, we're going to take actions that protect the American people, protect our security, our national security, and also protect our economy and jobs. That's the actions that you're seeing taken by President Trump. We'll continue to engage in those.
On Friday, with China ordering the United States to shut its consulate in the city of Chengdu in direct retaliation, hours after Pompeo denounced China as a tyranny at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in California.
What do the American people have to show now, 50 years on, from engagement with China? Did the theories of our leaders that proposed a Chinese evolution towards freedom and democracy prove to be true? Is this China's definition of a win-win situation? And indeed, centrally, from Secretary of State's perspective, is America safer? Do we have a greater likelihood of peace for ourselves and peace for the generations which will follow us? Look, we have to admit a hard truth. We must admit a hard truth that should guide us in the years and decades to come. That if we want to have a free 21st century and not the Chinese century of which Xi Jinping dreams, the old paradigm of blind engagement with China simply won't get it done. We must not continue it, and we must not return to it. As President Trump has made very clear, we need a strategy that protects the American economy and indeed our way of life. The free world must triumph over this new tyranny.
And that's Secretary of State Pompeo. President Richard Nixon made the first opening with China's government in February 1972. Nixon spoke in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing.
The Chinese people are a great people. The American people are a great people. We have at times in the past been enemies. We have great differences today. What brings us together is that we have common interests which transcend those differences.
And that's Richard Nixon in 1972. The author of Flags of Our Fathers, the story of the six United States Marines who raised the flag on Iwo Jima, is James Bradley. He says China isn't a lapdog, but a powerful country coming into its own.
America generally is looking to a mirage and not the reality on China. And the mirage here, you can hear it over and over and over in media interviews. American experts saying, gee, we opened up, we thought China would liberalize, we gave them a chance, and oh my God, they're not little Democrats like we wanted them to be. What happened? That was a mirage. China is not malevolent, it's just China. There's an emperor system, you know, and the emperor is now a bunch of guys on a committee, and China will be China. And America has difficulty with that. Look at, we're number one, China's number two, let's say economically. They're number, you know, whatever the measurements are. My case is, yes, this is natural that 1.4 billion people might have an economy larger than 330 million people. We could be a strong number two. Maybe America can double the size of its economy, double our wealth in a number two slot. China for thousands of years was the most dominant economic power in the world. They're not a third world country rising. They are a first world country just getting back into their lane.
James Bradley is author of Flags of Our Fathers, the story of the six United States Marines who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. New York State Attorney General Letitia James announced today she's filing a lawsuit against President Trump for excluding undocumented immigrants from congressional apportionment in the 2020 census. Last year, Trump's attempt to add a question about citizenship on the census was shot down by the courts. The White House hit back with a new approach. A memorandum directing Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross to exclude undocumented immigrants who might be included in the census count from the apportionment base, or the base population that's used to divide up seats in Congress. The U.S. Constitution mandates congressional representation be divided among states based on a count of every person residing in the country, but the Constitution, Trump wrote, does not define which persons must be included in the apportionment base. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security apologized to the federal court for inaccurate and misleading statements in a case over banning New Yorkers from the Global Entry Program. The letter was filed as part of a pair of lawsuits brought by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. DHS announced in February that New Yorkers would no longer be permitted to enroll or renew their membership in trusted traveler programs that allow travelers to move through security faster at airports and land borders. The White House was responding to the New York State's green light law. Was responding to New York State's green light law that restrict immigration authorities from access to driver's license records. And Mayor Bill de Blasio got testy over a question fielded by WBAI's Jillian Jonas and the city's lack of help for small businesses, especially unregulated commercial rents. De Blasio put his faith in the landlords.
everything has been thrown for such a loop that I, again, what I said, I stand by. I would hope that this is not business as usual. This is not like the normal realities with landlords. I would hope landlords would realize, both morally and practically, that if they throw out a tenant, they're not going to have someone to replace them anytime soon. Told you about the legal problems with commercial rent control that I truly believe are there under the laws of this nation and this state. And I said in State of the City, we want to see if there's a way to find a new model.
And that's Mayor Bill de Blasio. But New York City small business owners, many in communities of color and owned by immigrants, say little is being done to help them in these difficult times. The coordinator of United for Small Business Coalition is Karen Narewski.
We know that, you know, some cities around the country are really depending on the federal government for much more assistance than they've shown. And a lot of the city's response to the issues small businesses are facing has been to refer business owners to the Paycheck Protection Program and economic injury disaster loans that the federal government is offering. It's been really challenging, especially for minority and immigrant business owners to access some of those loans. So I believe there was a national survey that came out a few weeks ago showing that only 12% of Black and Latino business owners who applied for those loans across the country actually received the funds that they were applying for.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's true for a number of reasons. One, maybe a sort of longstanding structural imbalance in access to credit. So it's already easier for a lot of white-owned businesses to get loans to, maybe they didn't start their business in as much debt because they were able to get loans to open their business. Some of those inequities are really baked in to continuing to be able to access credit. I think also, obviously, in a place like New York, where there's such a large immigrant population, there are language barriers in terms of people being able to understand the applications and get all the things together that they need. And also, there aren't, not all businesses sort of operate in the same way. So we're seeing especially sole proprietorships, street vendors, worker cooperatives, who maybe don't do payroll in the same way as traditional business, don't have the same paperwork. There are businesses in New York that are owned by undocumented immigrants who don't have a social security number and so can't fill that out on the form. There's a number of reasons why that might be true. And it also may be in a place like New York where commercial rents are really high. The Paycheck Protection Loan was mostly, as the name indicates, for payroll, for people to be able to pay their workers. If someone's got a business and they're not able to bring people back to work because the pandemic is still ongoing, what they really need to do is pay rent. The PPP loan actually didn't really allow businesses to do that.
The mayor, he can't really get involved with any sort of legislation that would give businesses any sort of rent protection, the government helping in a competitive situation.
Obviously, any sort of rent relief program would have to be structured in such a way that it's not appearing to play favorites or discriminate by neighborhood or anything like that. But I do think because of the emergency situation that we're in and because of the impact of small businesses throughout the local economy, this is really the time for the mayor and the council to step up and look at things like rent relief, like special emergency grant programs for businesses. One of the other things that we've been hearing is that businesses are really concerned about code violations as they attempt to comply with the new rules of the outdoor dining program. And even for businesses that are not outdoors, I think, you know, it's important to make sure businesses are operating safely and that everybody who's working there and shopping there is safe, given especially with the Open Streets program that the regulations are evolving very quickly. We want to make sure especially that more vulnerable businesses are not being targeted for large fines that kind of compound the situation.
Karen Narewski is coordinator of the United for Small Business Coalition. As public health officials warned Friday that the coronavirus posed new risks to parts of the Midwest and South, enhanced federal payments that helped avert financial ruin for millions of unemployed Americans are set to expire, leaving threadbare safety nets offered by individual states to catch them. Since early in the pandemic, the federal government has added $600 to the weekly unemployment checks that states send. That increase ends this week. And with Congress still haggling over next steps, most states will not be able to offer nearly as much. In addition to the end of the $600 payments, federal protections against evictions are also set to expire. Standard unemployment benefits often leave recipients with poverty-level incomes, but they are sure to continue, even as states wrestle with diminishing unemployment trust funds. And in Portland, Portland, Oregon. 18 people were arrested this week on federal charges while protesting the presence of federal agents in the city. That doesn't include arrests made last Friday when the agents used tear gas on protesters. Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf previously said there had been 43 federal arrests as of Tuesday. The news of additional arrests came hours after a federal judge late Thursday blocked U.S. agents from arresting or using physical force against journalists and legal observers at the protests. U.S. Judge Michael Simon made his ruling about media and observers a day after Portland's mayor was tear gassed by federal agents while making an appearance outside the courthouse during raucous demonstrations. The judge said objections by law enforcement were outweighed by First Amendment concerns. Journalists and observers must wear clear identification, he said. The ACLU lawsuit is one of several filed in response to law enforcement action during the protests. The state of Oregon is seeking an order limiting federal agents' arrest powers during the demonstrations. And the New York Civil Liberties Union is blasting a federal court decision restraining the legal group from releasing police misconduct records. The records were obtained after passage of a law repealing another law known as 50A that had kept records of police misconduct secret for decades. The judge in the case sided with city police union leaders who sued the city to keep the records private. Some of the records are of unsubstantiated claims against cops, but civil liberties lawyers say that doesn't mean the officer was innocent. The Civil Liberties Union wasn't part of the lawsuit, but filed a friend of the court brief. A legal fellow at the New York Civil Liberties Union is Jordan Laris Cohen.
The information in the database contains records, rather, regarding, again, complaints that the board found to be substantiated, as well as unsubstantiated and unfounded. And just to be clear, where the board finds a case to be unsubstantiated, that does not mean that the board has found the claim to be without merit. The board is unable to fully investigate and make a finding.
And do you feel that all this information is important to be released?
It's absolutely crucial as to the category of unsubstantiated complaints because there are a variety of reasons for which a board may not reach a recommendation. It's quite vital for the public to have a full picture as to what complaints are being brought against individual officers, but also to get a picture as to how the board is operating.
What are you going to do next?
We're quite optimistic that the court is going to reconsider its decision and modify the order upon review of our submission yesterday evening. We hope that the database becomes a valuable resource for the public in holding police accountable and in seeking to transform the nature of policing in the state.
Who were the specific cops, may I ask, who you asked about?
I can't speak to the specific contents of the database, given that we are subject to a court order. But what I can say is that we requested the database records of individual officers recognized by the parties in open court that were in excess of 81,000 different officers that are contained in the database. But I can't say more, unfortunately, at this point. The court's order here, which constitutes a prior restraint on our discussion and release of that information, is really quite a remarkable and dramatic measure.
And that's Jordan Laris Cohen. He's a legal fellow at the New York Civil Liberties Union. And finally, Chicago temporarily removed two statues of Christopher Columbus on Friday and announced it would reassess the appropriateness of all its monuments a week after protesters had tried to topple one of the statues, leading to a violent clash with police. Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, said the step is about an effort to protect public safety and to preserve a safe space for an inclusive and democratic public dialogue about our city's symbols. Protesters for racial equality have targeted Columbus monuments across the United States, challenging portrayals of him in American education that downplay or ignore the explorer's cruelty towards indigenous peoples of the Americas. After consulting with stakeholders, Lightfoot ordered the removal of statues in Grant Park, Chicago's large recreation area, and another in the Little Italy district. Crews using cranes removed the statues in the pre-dawn darkness, leaving bare pedestals. The Chicago demonstrations, which resulted in several arrests and injuries, were among those that broke out across the United States in protests against police brutality sparked by the May 25th death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis. Columbus, the 15th century Genovese-born explorer who sailed for the Spanish crown, remains a powerful symbol for some Italian-American groups that oppose the downgrading of his status. And that's some of the news for Friday, July 24th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jillian Jonas. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News in New York, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.